are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 1st, 2023 Friday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Israel Knew of October 7 Attack by Ronan Bergman and Adam Goldman of the New York Times. Cities Must Replace Harmful Lead Pipes Under EPA Plan by Michael Phillips and Matthew Daly of the Associated Press. Colorado's Long COVID Clinics Can't Meet Demand by Meg Wingerder of the Denver Post. Debate Flares Up Downtown by John Aguilar of the Denver Post, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Israel Knew of October 7 Attack by Ronan Bergman and Adam Goldman of the New York Times. Israeli officials obtained Hamas's battle plan for the October 7 terrorist attack more than a year before it happened, documents, emails, and interviews show. But Israeli military and intelligence officials dismissed the plan as aspirational, considering it too difficult for Hamas to carry out. The approximately 40-page document, which Israeli authorities codenamed Jericho Wall, outlined point by point exactly the kind of devastating invasion that led to the deaths of about 1,200 people. The translated document, which was reviewed by the New York Times, did not set a date for the attack, but described a methodical assault designed to overwhelm the fortifications around the Gaza Strip, take over Israeli cities, and storm key military bases, including a division headquarters. Hamas followed the blueprint with shocking precision. The document called for a barrage of rockets at the outset of the attack, drones to knock out the security cameras and automated machine guns along the border, and gunmen to pour into Israel en masse, in paragliders, on motorcycles, and on foot, all of which happened October 7th. The plan also included details about the location and size of Israeli military forces, communication hubs, and other sensitive information, raising questions about how Hamas gathered its intelligence and whether there were leaks inside the Israeli security establishment. The document circulated widely among Israeli military and intelligence leaders, but experts determined that an attack of that scale and ambition was beyond Hamas's capabilities, according to documents and officials. It is unclear whether Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or other top political officials saw the document as well. Last year, shortly after the document was obtained, officials in the Israeli military's Gaza division, which is responsible for defending the border with Gaza, said Hamas's intentions were unclear. It is not yet possible to determine whether the plan has been fully accepted and how it will be manifested, read a military assessment reviewed by The Times. Then in July, just 3 months before the attacks, a veteran analyst with Unit 8200, Israel's Signals Intelligence Agency, warned that Hamas had conducted an intense day-long training exercise that appeared similar to what was outlined in the blueprint. But a colonel in the Gaza division brushed off her concerns, according to encrypted emails viewed by The Times. "I utterly refute that the scenario is imaginary," the analyst wrote in the email exchanges. "The Hamas training exercise," she said, "fully matched the content of Jericho Wall. It is a plan designed to start a war," she added. "It's not just a raid on a village." Officials privately concede that, had the military taken these warnings seriously and redirected significant reinforcements to the south, where Hamas attacked, Israel could have blunted the attacks or possibly even prevented them. Instead, the Israeli military was unprepared as terrorists streamed out of the Gaza Strip. It was the deadliest day in Israel's history. Israeli security officials have acknowledged they failed to protect the country, and the government is expected to assemble a commission to study the events leading up to the attack. The Jericho Wall document lays bare a years-long cascade of missteps that culminated in what officials now regard as the worst Israeli intelligence failure since the surprise attack that led to the Arab-Israeli War of 1973. Underpinning all these failures was a single, fatally inaccurate belief that Hamas lacked the capability to attack and would not dare to do so. That belief was so ingrained in the Israeli government, officials said, that they disregarded growing evidence to the contrary. The Israeli military and the Israeli security agency declined to comment. Officials would not say how they obtained the Jericho Wall document. Cities must replace harmful lead pipes under EPA plan. The agency move would aid IQ scores for children and lower blood pressure, heart disease in adults. By Michael Phyllis and Matthew Daly of the Associated Press. Most U.S. cities would have to replace lead water pipes within 10 years under strict new rules proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency as the Biden administration moves to reduce lead in drinking water and prevent public health crises like the ones in Flint, Michigan and Washington, D.C. Millions of people consume drinking water from lead pipes, and the agency said tighter standards would improve IQ scores in children and reduce high blood pressure and heart disease in adults. It is the strongest overhaul of lead rules in more than three decades and will cost billions of dollars. Pulling it off will require overcoming enormous practical and financial obstacles. These improvements ensure that in a not-too-distant future, there will never be another city and another child poisoned by their pipes, said Mona Hannah Atisha, a pediatrician and clean water advocate who raised early alarms about Flint. Denver Water has replaced 21,000 customer-owned lead service lines since 2019, according to spokesman Jimmy Luthi. It's part of a 15-year plan to replace all such lines in the company's system, work that received a federal stamp of approval and a major financial boost last year. After a pilot phase during which the utility replaced 15,000 pipes over 3 years, the Environmental Protection Agency last December gave full approval to Denver Water's $700 million initiative. Federal officials feel the unique approach, which eschewed using the chemical additive orthophosphate in favor of sending water filters to customers, using alternative treatment methods, and replacing lead service lines, could be a model for other communities. Biden's infrastructure law has infused the effort with $76 million, enough to replace an additional 7,000 pipes by the end of 2025. That puts the work on pace to finish more than a year ahead of its projected completion date in 2034, according to Luthi. Pre-program estimates indicated there were likely 64,000 to 84,000 customer-owned lead service lines in total throughout the system, he said. The Biden administration has previously said it wants all of the nation's approximately 9 million lead pipes to be removed, and rapidly. Lead pipes connect water mains in the street to homes and are typically the biggest source of lead in drinking water. They are most common in older industrial parts of the country. Lead crises have hit poorer, majority black cities such as Flint especially hard, propelling the risks of lead in drinking water into the national consciousness. Their impact reaches beyond public health. After the crises, tap water use declined nationally, especially among black and Latino people. The Biden administration says investment is vital to fix this injustice and ensure everyone has safe, lead-free drinking water. We're trying to right a long-standing wrong here, said Radhika Fox, chief of the EPA Office of Water. We're bending the arc toward equity and justice on this legacy issue. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat, Illinois, and Senator Cory Booker, Democrat, New Jersey, representing states that have faced lead crises, agreed in a joint statement citing the new rule and the Biden administration's infrastructure investments. We can make a lead-free future a reality for all, no matter the color of their skin or their zip code, it said. The proposal, called the Lead and Copper Rule Improvements, would for the first time require utilities to replace lead pipes even if their lead levels aren't too high. Most cities have not been forced to replace their lead pipes, and many don't even know where they are. There are some exceptions to the 10-year lead pipe replacement deadline. A few cities, such as Chicago, with lots of lead pipes, may get longer. Water utilities with dense networks of lead pipes, as many as 2,000 of them, also could get more than 10 years, the proposal says. The push to reduce lead in tap water is part of a broader federal effort to combat lead exposure that includes proposed stricter limits on dust from lead-based paint in older homes and child care facilities, and a goal to eliminate lead in aviation fuel. The EPA enacted the first comprehensive lead in drinking water regulations in 1991. Those have significantly helped reduce lead levels, but experts have said they left loopholes that keep lead levels too high, and lax enforcement allows cities to ignore the problem. We now know that having literally tens of millions of people being exposed to low levels of lead from things like their drinking water has a big impact on the population, and the current lead rules don't fix it, said Eric Olson, an expert with the Natural Resources Defense Council, who challenged the original regulations back in the early 1990s. We're hoping this new rule will have a big impact. In addition, the EPA announced it wants to lower the level of lead at which utilities are forced to take action, and federal officials are pushing cities to do a better job informing the public when elevated lead levels are found. Another change involves how lead is measured. Utilities would need to collect more samples, and this alone could have significant consequences. When Michigan did something similar, the number of communities flagged for having high lead levels skyrocketed. The public will have a chance to comment on the proposal, and the agency expects to publish a final version of the rule in fall 2024. There is then a waiting period before it goes into effect. Unlike other contaminants, lead seeps into drinking water that already has left the treatment plant. The main remedy is to add chemicals to keep it from leaching out of pipes and plumbing fixtures. It's hard. A home with dangerous lead levels can be next to a house with no lead exposure at all. It ultimately will be up to utilities to decide whether to pay the full cost of replacing lead pipes, which is too expensive for many people to afford. We strongly, strongly encourage water utilities to pay for it, Fox said. The American Water Works Association, an industry group, said it supports the agency's pipe replacement goals, but there would be significant challenges. Costs are going up. It's hard to secure homeowner permission to do pipe replacement work, and other contaminants, such as harmful forever chemicals called PFAs, also will vie for financial resources and time, the group said. President Donald Trump's administration addressed lead in water, issuing new standards just before the end of his term, after years of efforts by advocates. Those rules forced utilities to take stronger action when lead levels rose too high and required them to test daycare centers and schools. They also made communities locate their lead pipes. Initial inventories are due in October. But environmental groups criticized the rule for not going far enough. In response, the Biden administration said it would make the improvements officials announced Thursday. The 2021 infrastructure law included $15 billion to find and replace lead pipes. More will be needed. Additional federal funds are available to improve water infrastructure, and the APA is providing smaller communities with extra help. Some states, however, have been slower to attack the problem. A handful declined the first round of federal lead pipe funds. A few communities have replaced pipes quickly. After crises in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and Newark, New Jersey, officials paid for and efficiently replaced lead pipes, adopting novel rules that required homeowners to let construction crews onto their property to do the work. Replacing the country's lead pipes will be expensive, but the EPA says the health benefits far outweigh the cost. Those benefits, Fox said, are really priceless. Debate flares up downtown. Polis addresses pro-Israel gathering as protesters hammer on windows, by John Aguilar of the Denver Post. Governor Jared Polis told a gathering of hundreds of attendees at the Global Conference for Israel on Thursday night that this is a profoundly difficult time for the Jewish state in the wake of the abject cruelty and hatred wrought by Hamas against civilians nearly 2 months ago. The gathering opened as pro-Palestinian protesters geared up to oppose and potentially disrupt the event in downtown Denver this weekend. A group of about 60 protesters gathered Thursday evening at the Colorado Convention Center's Blue Bear and chanted, shouted, and banged on the windows. "We want to be loud, visible, and hostile to our enemies," an unidentified speaker said through a megaphone. The disruption could be heard inside the convention center, host to the annual conference, which is put on by the Jewish National Fund USA. The conference has become a local flashpoint in the weeks since Hamas carried out a deadly surprise attack on southern Israel, killing more than 1,200 and capturing nearly 250 people to be held as hostages. The Israeli military's response to the October 7 raid has left more than 13,000 Palestinians dead in the Gaza Strip, according to the Hamas-controlled health ministry, inflaming tensions around the world. On Thursday, Denver police closed a section of 14th Street between Stout and Walton Streets to vehicle traffic as a security measure, and it put up concrete barriers. The closure will be in effect until 8 p.m. Sunday. About 10 police vehicles blocked access to the front doors of the convention center Thursday night as protesters marched past the windows of the facility with signs and Palestinian flags. Security was tight at the event, with heavily armed law enforcement officers stationed throughout the convention center. Polis delivered welcoming remarks at the conference, which is scheduled to last through Sunday. "There's a lot of pain, and it's made worse by the rise of anti-Semitism and hate," the governor said. "Our greatest strength is our ability to stand together. Together, we must fight all forms of hate." The governor's appearance at the conference was denounced by the Colorado-Palestine Coalition. The group labeled Polis hypocrite-in-chief on its Instagram page and accused him of welcoming some of Israel's most noted Islamophobes and racist genocidaires to Denver. The organization has called for a shutdown of the conference, and on Monday, pro-Palestinian demonstrators speaking out against the Global Conference for Israel took over the chamber of City Council, causing the meeting to be postponed. Yaron Marcus, an Israeli-American who serves as the vice president of the Mountain States region of the Jewish National Fund USA, said his parents were called Zionist racist pigs as they entered the conference Thursday. "It's disheartening," he said inside the convention center. "The protesters this year are angry, hostile, and threatening," said Marcus, who grew up in a Tel Aviv suburb and now lives in Denver. "And they erroneously conflate the American arm of the organization to the Israel-based Jewish National Fund organization," he said. "We own no land in Israel," Marcus said. "We are a nonprofit whose mission is to carry out humanitarian and other philanthropic endeavors in Israel." Polis, who is Jewish, told the Denver Post through a spokesman last week that Israel has a right to defend its citizens against Hamas and to respond to the brutal murder of hundreds of Israeli citizens and to work to facilitate the return of hundreds of hostages. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. Polis' spokesman Connor Cahill added that hate against any faith in Colorado will not be tolerated, and that includes ensuring that any effort to intimidate or prevent people from speaking to a group of Jewish Americans convening in Denver does not succeed. Many pro-Palestinian activists accuse the Jewish National Fund of supporting policies that have displaced Palestinians from their land and have resulted in the severe curtailment of their rights as they seek to create a nation-state of their own. Sarah Kaplan Gould, a member leader of the Denver Boulder chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, said the Jewish National Fund USA supports a vision in Israel that does not support equality for Palestinians and for all people. Jewish Voice for Peace calls for an end to U.S. support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians on its website. It also calls for a permanent ceasefire in the current war. A tenuous ceasefire that began a week ago was extended Thursday to release hostages, but it's not clear how long it will last. "The JNF doesn't represent Jews everywhere," said Kaplan Gould, who is Jewish. "I'm here to say, not in my name." Jewish Voice for Peace plans to hold an interfaith solidarity picket near the convention center on Friday and another downtown protest Sunday. The actions are among a number of events being promoted by the Colorado-Palestine Coalition this weekend, including a planned Friday walkout of Denver Public Schools students and a rally and march at the state capitol on Saturday. "I hope that people in Denver who are not sure they should speak out for Palestinian rights know they have a place and a community here and in Israel who recognize the intertwined fates of Jews and Palestinians," Kaplan Gould said. Marcus countered that Israel's fight isn't with Palestinian civilians. "We're not at war with Palestinians. We're not at war with Gaza," he said. "We're at war with Hamas, the terrorist organization that governs Gaza." The New York Times on Thursday published the results of several recent polls that showed that the level of support for Israel among Americans is decidedly stronger than U.S. support for Palestinians. In a Marist poll, 61% of respondents said they sympathized more with Israelis and 30% sympathized more with Palestinians. An NBC poll conducted in November showed that 47% of Americans say they feel positively toward Israel, while 24% feel negatively toward the country. Only 1% of Americans feel positively about Hamas, while 81% feel negatively about the militant group, the poll found. A mid-November Quinnipiac poll asked Americans who was more responsible for the outbreaks of violence in Israel and Gaza. 69% pointed to Hamas, and 15% chose Israel. Colorado's long COVID clinics can't meet demand. Project ECHO, ECHO, is working to train medical practitioners across the state, by Meg Wingerder of the Denver Post. Colorado doesn't have enough capacity to treat everyone suffering with long COVID at the three specialized clinics in the state, so public health leaders are trying to figure out ways for more people to get the care they need closer to home. Three multidisciplinary clinics in the state see long COVID patients at National Jewish Health in Denver, UC Health in Aurora, and Family Health West in Fruta. Together, they've treated about 10,000 people since mid-2020, a significant number, but nowhere near everyone in need, said Dr. Sarah Jolly, a medical director at the UC Health post-COVID clinic. Researchers estimated in November 2022 that between 228,000 and 651,000 Coloradans had symptoms that lingered after a COVID-19 infection, what has become known as long COVID. Some people have relatively mild symptoms, such as loss of smell, while others are unable to work or care for themselves because of extreme fatigue or brain fog. Some report their conditions improve over time, while others see no change or get worse. One idea to bring care to more people with long COVID is building on Project Extension for Community Health Outcomes, or ECHO, which connects primary care providers with specialists to learn how to manage certain conditions locally and to discuss complex patients. It started in New Mexico and initially focused on teaching rural providers to treat patients with hepatitis C, but it has expanded over time. Dr. Kyle Leggett, primary care liaison for Project ECHO in Colorado, said the group put together 7 online courses to cover the basics of long COVID care, which are free to providers who want them. They're still working on setting up groups for more in-depth training and consultation, he said. We really need every provider who meets patients in the ambulatory care setting to know what long COVID is, he said. Even if care is available in someone's community, it doesn't do much good if they can't afford it, said Chelsea Baker Hauk, a long COVID patient who spoke at a roundtable hosted by Lieutenant Governor Diane Primavera on Wednesday. She said one drug seems to be preventing more damage from her immune system, attacking multiple body tissues, but it was a tough fight to get her insurance to cover it, and she expects to have to go through the same battle again soon. The state also needs to make other supports more accessible, like disability payments, Baker Hauk said. A friend of hers who also has long COVID recently lost her home because she was unable to work and spent much of her savings trying to repair her immune system, which is no longer protecting her from routine infections, she said. She's not going to live to see her first disability payment, she said. Research suggests people newly infected with COVID-19 now are at a lower risk for lingering symptoms than they were earlier in the pandemic because of immunity from vaccination and prior infections, as well as changes in the virus itself. That said, some still become seriously ill, placing them at a higher risk for long COVID. As of Tuesday, 267 people in Colorado were hospitalized for COVID-19, and the number of people admitted on an average day was rising both in the state and nationwide. Allison Sabrana, a disability activist for Fort Collins who spoke at the roundtable in Aurora, said the state's infrastructure for treating post-viral syndromes has improved since the pandemic started. She developed myalgic encephalomyelitis, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome, in 2014 after an infection with the virus that causes mononucleosis. She bounced from specialist to specialist for years with no help, and it was extremely difficult to find someone who could treat her health as a whole and coordinate her care, she said. While having three multidisciplinary clinics is an improvement over the landscape when she got sick, patients with post-viral conditions still face significant barriers to care, Sobrana said. For example, some people with cognitive symptoms of long COVID can't drive, and not everyone has a relative or friend who can take them to Denver for appointments, she said. It would be an enormous lift for me to come down here and get care, Sobrana said. Project Echo could be a partial solution, especially because the organizers seem interested in hearing from patients about what isn't working in the current system, Sobrana said. Primary care doctors are accustomed to managing their patients' health needs, so involving them would take the burden of scheduling and coordination off people struggling with daily life, she said. If you can keep it in primary care and teach them what they need to know, you're going to prevent these patients falling through the cracks, she said. Parent demands right to display straight pride flags, by Jacob Factor of the Denver Post. A Denver Public Schools parent has sued the district over its policy allowing teachers to display progress pride flags in their classrooms, saying LGBTQ+ flags discriminate against his straight, cisgender white children. Nathan Feldman, whose children attend Slavin School in southeast Denver's Welsher neighborhood, on November 10th filed a federal lawsuit in the U.S. District of Colorado that states DPS's policy supporting LGBTQ+ students is not inclusive of all students or of his children who are heterosexual, Caucasian, and or binary cisgender. The lawsuit comes after his unsuccessful attempts to have what he describes as a straight pride flag displayed in his children's classrooms. The lawsuit alleges Feldman and his children have suffered irreparable harm directly because of the district's policy, and it seeks an injunction stopping the district from enforcing the policy that prohibits the straight flag display and a declaratory judgment on the unconstitutionality of the policy. The lawsuit also seeks $3 million in punitive damages from Slavin School Principal Kurt Siebold, DPS Director of Operations Christina Sylvester, and DPS Family Constituency Specialist Catherine Diaz, who are named individually in the lawsuit, as well as the district, the DPS School Board, Superintendent Alex Marrero, and two of Feldman's children's teachers. According to the lawsuit, Feldman asked the district to display a flag he described in an email as a straight pride flag, a black and white striped flag with linked male and female gender symbols on it, in front of his children's classrooms to include them, but the district did not respond to his request. Each day at school, Feldman's children are exposed to dozens, if not hundreds, of progress pride flags that DPS officials have strung throughout the Slavin School classrooms and the halls as a means of expressing and promoting DPS's favored viewpoint on the topic, the lawsuit states. Due to the fact that Feldman and his children's views differ, Feldman and his children simply request to have their views expressed as well. But DPS has refused and continues to refuse to permit Feldman and his children's speech or expression to even exist in its schools. Feldman first raised his concerns about pride flags to the district October 6, 2022, according to the lawsuit, after he attended the school event and saw progress pride flags displayed in front of classrooms. He asked his children's teachers about the flag displays because pride flags are not inclusive of all Slavin's school students and only represent one viewpoint on the topic of sex, and if he could have the straight pride flag displayed as well. Neither teacher responded, so he sent a follow-up email that Siebold answered, explaining district policy that supports teachers' right to display a rainbow flag or any other sign of support for LGBTQ+ students. The lawsuit alleges Siebold's response and DPS policy confirms the district does not allow students or staff to speak or express support for students or staff who are not members of the LGBTQIA+ community. Siebold later allegedly sent an email that stated in part, DPS doesn't allow for other flags, according to the lawsuit. Feldman went back and forth with DPS officials and school administrators and faculty members, saying the use of the pride flags and alleged non-allowance for other flags violates the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. He also sent an email to Sylvester stating he'd like to follow diversity, equity, and inclusion policies to display a straight pride flag with two gender symbols in front of his children's classrooms. He met with Siebold and Diaz in January, where Diaz allegedly said, "Sexual orientation, gender identity, and race protections only apply to homosexuals, people of color, and trans people." Feldman claims, according to the lawsuit, straight, white, cisgender people should be members of protected classes or protected against discrimination because those are parts of sexual orientation, race, and gender identity. Feldman and his children are being represented by Michael Yoder and Chad LaVeglia, Washington, D.C.-based attorneys. DPS Director of External Communications Scott Pribble said, as of Monday, the district had not been served the lawsuit, but even if it had, it could not comment on pending litigation. President resigns, successor promises less drama, by Sam Tabachnik of the Denver Post. The president of Douglas County School Board on Thursday announced his resignation after a tumultuous tenure leading the suburban district. Mike Peterson, during a special meeting of the board Thursday evening, said he planned to resign at the end of the meeting, effective today. He previously told the Douglas County News Press that he was stepping down because his family was moving out of state. Peterson's term would have expired in November 2025. Christy Williams, like Peterson, a member of the board's conservative majority, was elected by a 4-3 vote to become the next board president. Peterson declined to recuse himself, voting for Williams over Director Susan Meek. The directors, in nominating Meek and Williams for the chairperson role, said it was crucial the board avoid the bitter infighting that marked the previous 2 years under Peterson. Williams cited 25 years of leadership experience as proof that she would make a good board president. "I don't stir up drama," she said. Three board members were officially sworn in Thursday evening: Meek and incumbent, Brad Geiger and Valerie Thompson. All three won in November's election and opposed conservative policies promoted by the board's majority, which, in addition to Peterson and Williams, includes Becky Myers and Kaylee Winiger. When a member resigns, Douglas County's school board has 60 days to appoint a replacement. The president holds the tie-breaking vote in the event of a split. Peterson's time helming Colorado's third-largest school district has been marked by controversy. The four-member conservative majority secretly decided in February 2022 to fire the district's superintendent, Corey Wise, without informing the rest of the board. A judge later ruled that the majority violated Colorado open meeting laws. The district ended up paying more than $100,000 as part of a lawsuit. Wise, in April of last year, filed a state and federal discrimination complaint against the school district and the four conservative board members, saying he was fired unlawfully because he advocated for students with disabilities and students of color. The district settled that lawsuit this year and agreed to pay Wise more than $830,000. The superintendent fiasco led to widespread protests from Douglas County teachers, students, and parents. In brief, a four-year-old boy from Olt was killed in a collision with a train near Weld County Road 88 and U.S. 85 in Pierce on Saturday, according to the State Patrol. The boy was in a vehicle with his parents and brother when the crash happened, family members wrote on a crowdfunding page. The driver, a 26-year-old woman, was not able to stop before the railroad crossing because of snowy and icy road conditions, family members wrote. "Road conditions were not included in the initial crash report," said Trooper Gabriel Moltrer. "They will be included in the full report later." The crash occurred at 10:12 a.m. when a Subaru Cross truck was traveling west across County Road 88 and proceeded through the stop sign at a rail crossing, Moltrer said. A Union Pacific train traveling south on the tracks struck the rear side of the Subaru, forcing the vehicle off the road onto an embankment. The woman driving the Subaru and a 26-year-old male passenger were wearing seatbelts and sustained moderate injuries, Martrer said. The 4-year-old boy and a 2-year-old boy were in front-facing child seats. The 4-year-old boy died at the hospital, Moltres said, and the 2-year-old sustained serious injuries. The parents have been discharged from the hospital, and the 2-year-old is in intensive care, according to an updated posted Tuesday by the family. A pedestrian was killed in a crash Thursday afternoon that closed Federal Boulevard at West 10th Avenue, according to the Denver Police Department. The driver remained at the scene. The pedestrian's identity will be released by the Denver Medical Examiner's Office. The cause of the crash is under investigation, police said Thursday. City to buy former Denver Post building in $89 million deal. Documents indicate plans include moving some court operations that need more space, by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. The city of Denver, no longer content to be a tenant in the former Denver Post building downtown, is moving to buy the 11-story structure for $88.5 million. Its purchase deal with the New York-based owner of 101 West Colfax Avenue is intended to make room for the city and county's courts. Many of the non-criminal courts are squeezed into the historic city and county building across Civic Center. They're expected to need an additional 280,000 square feet of space by 2040, according to a court's master plan. The building is just shy of 306,000 square feet and is in the heart of downtown with building security, an auditorium, connections to the city's computer network, and a 635-space parking garage. The Post reported this week that city officials were considering purchasing the building. The proposed contract is up for consideration before the City Council's Finance and Governance Committee on Tuesday morning. If it earns approval from the entire council in coming weeks, the deal could close in March, according to city documents. The Post building would help the city meet space requirements for district, county, probate, and juvenile courts, as well as provide dedicated space for nonprofit and judicial advocate services like Colorado Legal Services and multiple rental assistance programs, which currently have undedicated space in other city buildings, Laura Swartz, a spokeswoman for Denver's finance department, said Thursday. In addition to courtrooms in the city and county building, less than 2 blocks from the building it plans to buy, Denver has court uses in the Minoru Yasui building, the Lindsay Flanagan Courthouse, and the Van Cise-Simonette Detention Center today, Swartz said. All of those buildings are clustered along West Colfax Avenue between Bannock and Fox Streets. The building opened in 2006 as the joint headquarters of the Post and the Rocky Mountain News, which closed in 2009. The Post's newsroom and other operations moved out of the building in 2018 into space at the paper's printing plant in Adams County, but the Post's ownership group still holds a master lease for the building and subleases that space to other tenants, including the city. The building is owned by KN LLC, an affiliate created by American Properties, which paid $93.4 million for it in 2006 as construction was concluding. That price was higher than the city proposes to pay now, especially when adjusted for inflation. The difference likely reflects in part the impact of high vacancy rates in downtown office buildings after the pandemic changed commuting and remote work habits. A presentation prepared by the city for the council committee hearing says the negotiated price falls within the appraisal value. Bill Mosher led the development of the Post building. Now with Trammell Crow Company, Mosher also developed the city's Wellington E. Webb Municipal Office Building and the state's Ralph L. Carr Colorado Judicial Center, among other buildings near Civic Center. Even as values have declined, Mosher said he views the proposed sale as a good deal for the city and the seller. The city's occupancy should generate plenty of needed activity on the eastern end of the under-renovation 16th Street Mall, he said. There are cheaper buildings in the tech center in downtown right now, Mosher said. I think it's well located, he added, in a way that allows the city to consolidate courts and courts-adjacent uses. The city's contract will come before the council just as work is ramping up on a 2-year, $133.5 million renovation of the Webb building at 201 West Colfax across the street from the Post's old building. The Webb building is home base to 2,100 city employees. The renovation has been touted as a way to maximize space in that building and make room for 600 city workers now using subleased floors in the former Post building. The Post building's proximity to existing downtown courthouses makes this a preferred location, Swartz said. The building also already houses city staff and has the city's IT infrastructure installed. The city began subleasing space from the Post's owner in 2016, and it has expanded since then to include more floors. The city's cumulative sublease deal is worth just shy of $44 million through 2029. Late that year is when the Post ownership's master lease will expire, according to the council hearing presentation. Until then, city documents say the building's leasing structure will help pay off debt the city is taking to finance the purchase. The city plans to issue certificates of participation, a form of borrowing that pledges city assets and isn't subject to voter approval, unlike municipal bonds. As the city takes over as landlord, it plans to continue charging rent to the Post's ownership, amounting to $7.8 million in the first year. That money will come from parking revenue and sublease payments made by tenants, including the city. After 2029, the city will take over all leasing functions, according to the documents. City Councilman Chris Hines represents the Civic Center area as part of his District 10. Moving to buy the former Post building is the city putting our money where our mouth is, he said. Here we are demonstrating that we truly believe that downtown is at an inflection point, Hines said, and that it will reemerge as a welcoming place to live, work, and play, just as it has been in the past. Coal mine is shedding jobs before power plant's coal-to-gas conversion, by Mead Groover of the Associated Press. A Wyoming coal mine that supplies fuel to a power plant that will be converted to burn gas plans to lay off 19 workers next month, the latest of thousands of jobs lost in the beleaguered U.S. coal industry in recent years. 15 workers at the Black Butte mine were told Monday, and four more Wednesday, they would lose their jobs in mid-December, mine manager Stephen Gilley said Wednesday. Most are heavy equipment operators, but some are mechanics and other mine staff. No additional layoffs are planned at the mine, where the workforce will shrink from 132 to 113, said Gilley, who declined to comment further. While northeastern Wyoming is home to 8 of the 10 most productive U.S. coal mines, Black Butte in the southwestern part of the state is a smaller operation. The mine east of Rock Springs in the sparsely populated Red Desert produces 2.5 million tons of coal a year, primarily to feed Pacific Core's nearby Jim Bridger power plant. That's less coal than the northeastern Wyoming mines produce in a week. Still, the announced layoffs drew the ire of state officials who blamed the President Joe Biden's administration for not facilitating the mine's expansion. It is disheartening and disappointing to have the Black Butte mine lay off employees at any time, but this is particularly troubling as we enter the holiday season, Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon, a Republican, said in a statement. The power plant could continue to burn coal under plans to expand carbon capture and sequestration in Wyoming, Gordon added. Nationwide, coal has been in decline as utilities have installed more renewable energy and converted coal fire plants to be fueled by cheaper and cleaner burning gas. At the Jim Bridger Power Plant, Portland, Oregon-based Pacific Core plans to convert two generators to gas next year following the remaining two in 2030. Such trends have sapped U.S. coal demand, and production has fallen from 1.3 billion tons a decade ago to 870 million tons in 2022, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. U.S. coal mining employment has shrunk by half over that period to about 40,000 workers, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Expect December to be colder than normal, from the Weather Almanac. Despite a cold outbreak at the end of the month, November averaged several degrees above normal over the central Rockies, including all of Colorado. November was a dry month as well, despite a couple of snowy events the latter third of the month. Expect a more active December with precipitation likely to average close to normal across Colorado, while temperatures average a few degrees lower than normal. That means that the majority of the precipitation that does fall during December will be in the form of snow. This is good news for the ski industry as well as skiers and snowmobile enthusiasts. A series of weak storms will bring light snowfall of a few inches to the state during the opening several days of the month. There will be a period from the December 4th through 12th when it will be relatively dry with cold, clear nights and sunny afternoons with temperatures near to above the historic averages. It will turn stormy at mid-month, then there may be a little break in the stormy weather in the days leading up to Christmas. The week between Christmas and New Year's Day may turn stormy once again. The odds of a white Christmas seem a little higher than usual this year. In sports, down in the desert, McKinnon's equalizer salvages point, but Avs fall in OT at Arizona, by Corey Masisic of the Denver Post. The Arizona Coyotes didn't score on the overtime power play that Nick Bjugstad created, but he was credited with the game winner just seconds after it ended. Avalanche defenseman Cale Makar appeared to accidentally put the puck in his own net as it slipped between goalie Alexander Georgiev's legs during a scramble just as the 4-on-3 power play expired and the Coyotes prevailed 4-3 at Mullet Arena. The Coyotes had a power play in the extra session because Bjugstad got behind Bo Byram and the defenseman slashed him to prevent a mini breakaway scoring chance. Another positive night from the power play helped the Avalanche get to overtime for the second time this season after falling behind early in the third period. The Avs had scored in 8 straight games on the power play coming into this contest, but Colorado had struck more than once with the man advantage only twice this season. Nathan McKinnon made it 3 times with a one-time blast at 11:04 of the third period to tie this game at 3-3. After a slow start to the season, the Avs' power play is now 11 for 40, or 27.5% in the past 9 games. This was also the 9th straight game that Colorado has won the special teams battle, a streak that began after the Avs allowed 4 special teams goals, 2 power play, 2 shorthanded, in an 8-2 loss to the St. Louis Blues. Given how consistently strong the Avalanche has been at even strength over the past several seasons, opposing teams know that not outscoring the Avs on special teams is going to significantly reduce their chances. Makar continued his torrid month offensively with a power play goal to open the scoring. Makar's shot from the top of the offensive zone with Valeri Nichushkin providing a screen has become a go-to weapon for the Avalanche with the extra man this season, and he did it again with 29 seconds left in the opening period. The goal was Makar's 7th tally of the season. He finished November with 4 goals and 24 points. The 20 assists are the most by a defenseman in the month of November in league history. Travis Boyd leveled the score 3 minutes and 3 seconds into the second period, though Georgiev did not like the events that occurred in front of him just before the puck went past him. Liam O'Brien skated in front of the goalie and knocked Avs defenseman Devon Taves into him. Just as Georgiev was getting squared up to the puck again, Boyd shot one that appeared to hit something in front of the goaltender. He slammed his stick on the ice a couple of times after the scoreboard replay, but the Avs coaching staff declined to challenge for goalie interference. Miles Wood got behind the Coyotes' defense to give the Avs another lead less than 2 minutes later. Caleb Jones chipped the puck along the right wall in the Arizona end, and after Wood corralled it, he took a direct route to the net. Wood was able to wrap his shot around Coyotes' goalie Connor Ingram for his 4th goal of the season at 4:44 of the period. The Avs did allow an Arizona power play goal late in the second period. It came 11 seconds after Jones went to the box, with Nick Schmaltz finding a soft spot in the middle of the Colorado defense for a one-timer. The Avalanche penalty kill was 27 of 29 since the St. Louis debacle before this contest. Michael Carcone gave the Coyotes their first lead of the night 68 seconds into the third period. He skated out from behind the Avalanche net for a wraparound try and was able to tuck it past Alexander Georgiev inside the far post. New head coach Armas presses for immediate turnaround in Colorado, by Brendan Plone, special to the Denver Post. The new era of Colorado Rapids soccer will be brash, in-your-face, and Centennial State-approved. At least that's how Bronx-born Long Island native Chris Armas said he wants his new team to play in Commerce City. The Rapids formally introduced Armas as their 10th permanent head coach in club history on Thursday afternoon at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. The former MLS star, who spent 12 seasons playing for the LA Galaxy and Chicago Fire before transitioning into coaching, addressed several topics while speaking with media members in addition to his preferred style of play. Here's what Armas and club president Padre Smith had to say, leaning on tough times. What's the story? Armas's coaching track record has been a mixed bag as he led the New York Red Bulls to an Eastern Conference final in his first year in charge, but eventually was fired in September 2020. He lasted 11 games in charge of Toronto's FC in 2021 before getting the boot during a COVID-filled season in which Canadian teams could not play in their home market or go home at all for most of the season. Assistant roles at English Premier League Giants Manchester United for 6 months and Leeds United less than 2 months were also short-lived. Considering where Colorado is, 2 years removed from a first-place finish in the Western Conference, but coming off of its worst season in franchise history filled with off-field problems and a fan protest that lasted from September through the season finale, Armas will use the tough time to find good ones in Commerce City. What Armas said, "The key thing with all of my stops on my football journey is that I've learned along the way and that I'm more ready now than I've ever been. I can take something from every experience and promise the fan base, look, I know how to coach. Well, my superpower? Listen, I know football, of course. I'm learning all the time, but I know people and I know competition. Just give us some time. I understand their frustration, and I think we're going to make them proud." Analysis? If Armas is to be the one to dig Colorado out of its current hole, he'll be the first to grab a shovel and start finding a route. Whether learning under transition game coaching legends in New York and Germany, keeping a team together in Toronto in a tough situation, or later working with world-class players in the world's most cutthroat league, one thing is clear. Armas is not messing around. Game model is afoot. What's the story? The club president has increasingly stressed a club identity to use altitude and transition soccer to wear teams down and win tough games. Armas's plan matches Smith's. What Smith said, "I don't think there's a better proponent of transition football than Chris domestically. We understood when we brought him in that he not only believed in that, but knew exactly how to execute that, get players to buy into that, knew how to get players to perform that day in, day out." Analysis? Armas said he has always seen soccer one way, to make it hard to play against. As a product of the notorious Red Bulls high press system, he'll make sure his tactical philosophy is understood by all. But after scoring an abysmal 26 goals in 2023, can it be an overnight switch? With Smith and Armas on the same page, there's a chance. Drive toward youth. What's the story? Colorado has 14 senior players on its roster, 24 or younger, suited for Armas' style of play, plus a talented Rapids 2 squad that also played run-and-gun soccer. With key veterans leaving, the expectation Smith set Thursday is that Armas can transform a young and hungry squad with a chip on its shoulder from 28th in MLS to a playoff team in the span of one season. Armas highlighted the likes of Connor Ronan, Cole Bassett, Rafael Navarro, and Moise Bambito as players he's eager to coach. Armas said, "We're a club that's going to push the young players. The young players don't let you down. You've just got to give them a chance. Philosophically, we're going to push young players that they can play with a fearless nature." Analysis? It's a new era in Commerce City, and the Rapids are looking to reinvent themselves from a gritty club with veterans to a bold and daring one where young players can thrive. It's now Armas's job to deliver that on expectation. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.